Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Deputy Director, Mary Ann Page. This series brings scholars and poverty experts from around the country to discuss their work on United States poverty and poverty research. In April 2014, we hosted David Otter, a professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a research affiliate of the school's Abdul Jamil Lateef Poverty Action Lab. Otter studies the labor market impacts of technological change and globalization, earnings inequality, disability insurance and labor supply, and temporary help and other intermediated work arrangements. Here is Otter presenting his seminar, Wayward Sons, the Emerging Gender Gap in Labor Markets and Education.
I'm going to be talking about the emerging gender gap in labor markets and education. And this actually, when Anne invited me to speak, she asked me to speak about this paper, but this paper actually is, which I wrote with graduate student Melanie Washman last year, is really a kind of an overview of the literature and trying to connect some things and develop some ideas. But in fact, we did it as a kind of a training exercise for ourselves to immerse ourselves in the topic. So since then, we've been working on trying to extend the literature rather than just sort of digest it. And so I'm going to present some results towards the end that are brand new. They've only been seen by human eyes once last night in the hotel room. So this will be, they'll be almost as new to me as they are to you. Okay, so here's the outline. So, self-evident, males have traditionally occupied the kind of commanding heights of the economy, that no one needs to be convinced of that. Women are making rapid strides on many margins, on education, on occupational stature, on earnings, on labor force participation, and the median male is moving the opposite direction, actually. And I think that's well known, and I'm just going to document that. I'm not going to say too much more about that, except that the real focus of this work is the consequences this has for household environments and ultimately for children. And in particular, going to argue that changes in the labor market, which we think of as the causal force here, are contributing to declines not only in earnings and labor force participation, but also declines in marriage rates, very strikingly so. And this is changing household structures, creating a lot more inequality of household structure, and particularly rise of single-headedness. And there's a long literature about the consequences of single-headedness for outcomes. And we're going to focus on one aspect of that that's less studied, which is the gender differential in how single-headedness affects boys and girls. Our conjecture is that, in fact, that single-headedness amplifies the gender gap, disproportionately disadvantages males. And the new evidence I'm going to present is on that question. Okay, so here's the outline. So first, I'm just going to document this emerging gender gap. And that's quick. I'm going to review things you're probably all glancingly familiar with. Then I'm going to talk about the link between wages, household structure, and investment in kids. And I'm just going to pull together work by others and show you a few patterns. Then I'm going to talk, finally, the third part of the paper is the kind of the new stuff as of last night. So the relationship between household structure and the gender gap. First, I'll just discuss a little bit from the literature. Then I'll present preliminary evidence from the work that I'm doing with David Figlio, Chris Karbownik, and Melanie Wasserman. This is our collaboration, and this is this stuff is really, really, really brand new. Okay, so let me just sort of start with the overview facts. So the four dimensions I'm going to talk about are skills acquisition, occupational stature, wage growth, and employment rates. And this is, I think many of these things are well known to you. So this shows you high school graduation rates at age 35 by birth cohort up to 1975. So these people were 35 in 2010. And what you can see is, interestingly, for reasons that are really unknown, this plateaued for cohorts born in the early 1950s. And then there hasn't been a lot of progress until actually more recently there has been some uptick in high school graduation. But when we hit this plateau, female high school graduations rose relative to male high school graduation rates. And that's true in every demographic group, except, I think, Asian Americans. Asian Americans are the only demographic group that there is no gender gap in educational attainment. This shows you a percent of adults with a four-year college degree by age 35, again, among these cohorts. And as many of you know, this has a much more uneven pattern, right? There's this big surge and particularly associated with the Vietnam War era, and males believed, to some extent correctly, that you were likely to be able to defer service while you stayed in college. When the war ended, college-going rates fell for males, or college-going rates. They plateaued for females. Now, it also, of course, corresponded with the decline in the college wage premium, right? And Richard Freeman famously wrote a book, The Overeducated American. People read that book. They said, I shouldn't go to college. So Richard, the Richard effect is about this much, I think, right there. It's interesting, also, you might say, well, why did women respond to the Vietnam War since they weren't liable for a draft? And of course, maybe there are other reasons to go to college. So the anyway, what happens then is there's a period of hiatus for about 10 years where the college going rate has fallen. And by the way, these cohorts, right, when they enter the labor market in the early 1980s, right, you have a very rapid deceleration in the growth rate of new college entrants. And this is an incredibly important contributor to the rise of wage inequality in the United States, right? This was first documented by Katz and Murphy in their 1992 paper that basically the biggest contributor to growing education differentials in the 1980s and 1990s was not an acceleration of technological progress or demand shifts. It was a deceleration in supply of skilled labor. Things change again, and college-going rates start to rise, but they rise much more rapidly for females. So, for example, in 1980, looking at males and females 25 to 34, men were 7 percentage points more likely to have completed a four-year college degree. By 2008, among people 25 to 34, women were 8 percentage points more likely to have completed a college degree. So, as you know, women are already and will increasingly be the better educated sex. This is true, in fact, in almost all advanced economies, that women are more likely to go on for tertiary education. What's unusual in the U.S., two things. One is the kind of the incredible rapidity of the reversal, and two, the low rate of college going of males. So the gap between males and females isn't actually extraordinarily high here. What's remarkable is how low the denominator is, actually. But I will say, more recent evidence, and you can sort of start to see it here, over the last 10 years, there has been a pickup in college going again, both among males and females, and high school graduation. Okay. So skills acquisition is one dimension in which women have rapidly overtaken men. Another interesting one is occupational stature. So as many of you know, there's been a decline in employment in kind of middle skill occupations. So on the one hand, those occupations would be clerical, administrative support, sales, a lot of office production jobs, so to speak. And on the other would be production craft and labor jobs, and these are blue-collar production jobs. And what has moved in their stead, of course, is, on the one hand, highly skilled, credentialed, professional, technical, and managerial jobs, jobs that require a college degree or above, and also in-person service occupations. What's interesting to notice, first of all, if you look, contrast, so just to be clear, the blue is ages 25 to 39, the ages are 40 to 60, the red is 40 to 64, this is a change between 80 and 2009. You can see for both groups there's been a decline in the share of employment in the middle. For males, it's almost all in blue-collar occupations. For women, women's occupational distribution is less segregated than males, right? You have women in, there are a fair number of women in manufacturing, and men and women, of course, in clerical administrative sales. So they both polarize. In fact, women have polarized more. There's more of a decline in the share of activities. But the interesting difference is almost all of the decline for women has been absorbed by growth of movement of women into managerial, professional, and technical occupations, right? So if you look at it, it's 13 percentage points here, 16 percentage points here for women, whereas for males, among older workers, you see this movement into the professions, but among younger workers, about three-quarters of it is movement into typically lower-paid service occupations. So same set of labor market changes, arguably much more dramatic for women, right, because this has really been a function of automation, but seemingly women have responded to this more successfully, both through higher education and perhaps other things having to do with training, with experience, and also adaptability. In the same time period, there's also been a dramatic growth of wage inequality, as you know, among skill groups, but it looks different among men and women. So if we look at percentage change in real hourly wage levels, right, you can see for both groups, there's a relative rise in in wages of high versus low-educated workers. But for women, you barely cross the x-axis, right? Most of those are positive, at least weekly positive. So among women with post-college education, real hourly earnings have increased by, you know, about 35 percentage points in this period. If you look among men, the differential between high school and college has increased as much or more than among women, but a lot of that is because of the fall of the bottom of people with high school or lower education. And even it's more pronounced among the young than the old. About the same, actually. I take it back. The main point being that although education differentials have risen for both sexes, for males, a lot of the rise of differential comes from the fall of the reference group. But if you were to plot these for males and females over time, what you would see is they look similar, except the female trends are all upward sloping, and the male trends are all, you know, just fan out from relatively positive to very strongly negative. Okay. Interestingly, by the way, I was surprised when I looked at this. If we look at the gender gap in earnings, you can see it's fallen enormously at all education levels, right? So the blue is 1979, the red is 2010. So you can see it's fallen by more than half in this 30-year period. And this is among younger workers, this is among older workers. It's really remarkable. Now, that's a descriptive statement. I'm not trying to say that adjusts for all relevant factors, but it is an incredible compression. Nevertheless, I was still surprised. Well, maybe this is implied by the other. It's still the case that there is a significant gender gap at every education level, right? In fact, proportionally, the male advantage in earnings is highest at low education levels, proportionally. One should not exactly... So although I'm pointing out that women are more educated than men, and in many ways appear to be doing better, they are certainly gaining. They are not, on average, the highest earners in the economy, and that's not just a function of education composition, even, you know, across age or cohort or anything. Okay. Employment rates is the next thing I want to talk about. So this just shows you the employment population rates among black and white males and females ages 20 plus from 1973 to 2012. And you can see there's been a long downward trend in male employment to population rates. What's interesting, actually, is the 1990s were a very good period, and people talked a lot about the U.S. employment miracle, and Solow and Kruger edited a volume called the Roaring 90s, Can Full Employment Be Sustained? We got the answer to that just very shortly thereafter, no. But remarkably, if you look after 2000, after that first recession, the U.S. labor market never bounced back, in fact. Even if there had not been a great recession starting 2007, we still would have viewed the 2000s as a lost decade, right? So all the sort of crowing about the success of the U.S. labor market, all the gains relative to European labor markets, we gave up all those gains in the ensuing 7 years. And so the sort of downward trend of male employment has continued, and then, of course, fell off a cliff at starting the recession. Women's employment, interestingly, has been rising. It's been rising steadily, or not steadily, it's been rising considerably since the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century, now turn of the 21st century, but then actually it hits a kind of a plateau in the 90s from which it doesn't really change much. So it's an interesting fact that there's been a lot of advancement of women's education, a lot of advancement of women's earnings, but women's labor force participation has not been rising. But nevertheless, it fell a great deal less during the Great Recession. Okay, so that kind of sets the... I should mention the changes in employment to population, you'll see more of this in a minute, are, the declines are much greater among less educated males, right? You're not surprised by that. Okay, so here's the... So this kind of puts that together. So this shows you the changes, percentage change in real hourly wages of males who are working between 1979 and 2008. Each of these dots corresponds to, and these are males 25 to 39, corresponds to a race by education group. So, for example, black high school dropout, black high school grad, black some college, black college grad, black greater than college. On the y-axis is the percentage change in employment to population rates among those groups, right? And so what you can see is that groups that have had falling earnings among those who are working have very steep falls in employment rates, right? Now, there are lots and lots of adjustments you could make for selection and so on, but it's hard to tell a story where that isn't reflecting an adverse labor demand shift, right? Wait, in general, you know, in general, for example, these declines are biased in the positive direction, right? Because the presumably the lowest earners are selecting out, right? So the latent fall in wages of high school dropouts and high school graduates is probably greater than the observed falls, right? Nevertheless, even among accounting for the fact that these are biased toward in the positive direction, we still see these very strong correlation between declining employment rates and declining earnings. So this suggests, and this is kind of the first meta point of this talk, is labor market changes, I think, are a very big part of changes in employment and changes in the opportunity set, right? So things are, the labor market is changing in a way that is reducing the attractiveness or the availability of employment for less educated males. If I did this picture for women, it would not be nearly as steep.
Okay. Sorry, when you say labor market changes, you mean labor demand changes?
I do mean labor demand changes. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Okay, good. So now, all right, so that's really the first bullet point. Now I want to talk about the household side of this. Okay, so basically the idea, the main argument of the paper, of the Wayward Sons paper, which is really just an overview synthesis paper, says, you know, the starting point for us is adverse demand shifts against low education males, leading to falling wages and employment. The next point is, which I'll document, is reduced marriage worthiness. Low education women are choosing not to marry low educated men. However, there's not been a concomitant drop in fertility. Women and men are still having children, but it means that the home environment that those children are growing up in is different. In particular, being a single-parent household means several things. One, almost surely it means lower financial resources, right? So a majority of the poor households in America are mother-headed. The poverty rates among mother-headed households relative to father-headed households are four times as great. I'll document this. So one, it means a deficit of resources. Two, it means growing up in a less safe neighborhood, less good school system, just as a function of income. Two, it means a deficit of parental attention. You just are less likely to have high quality attention focused on you when there's only one parent in the household. It also, we can talk about this, it may change in many ways the dynamics of households, right? So there's evidence, for example, documenting that particularly boys have particularly strained relationships with stepdads or secondary parental figures. We'll talk about that. So this reduced quality of home environment, we're going to argue, lowers human capital acquisition, but then particularly, or at least differentially, for boys. And I'll talk about that. Okay. So let me just start off. Well, you say, those men aren't working. What are they doing? Well, one thing they're doing is they're being incarcerated. So this shows you the incarceration rates of males and females ages 25 to 39 between 1970 and 2010. This is just using census data. And that, unlike the current population survey, the census population records people who are in institutional living arrangements. And you can see just how remarkably high this is. So, for example, if you look at black men ages 25 to 39 who have less than a high school degree, almost 30% of them were incarcerated as of 2010. And that, of course, dramatically understates the fraction that are in contact with the criminal justice system, right? These are the ones who are currently incarcerated. It's an effect, right? Because when people are, when employment opportunities aren't good, it's plausible that people find other things to do. It's an effect, obviously, because incarceration likely affects people's future labor force participation and their employability as well. So, and there's really good work, or really interesting work, on the effect of incarceration. I'll just point you to a paper by Kerwin Charles and I forget the name of his, the first name of his co-author, Luell is the last name, and they look at across states at incarceration. They try to use variation in incarceration policies, moderately successfully, but basically they find that male incarceration, higher fractions of males being incarcerated, lowers the likelihood that women marry, reduces the quality of their spouses as measured by education, shifts the gains from marriage away from women towards men, right? So although these men are kind of less good partners, they have more bargaining power. There are fewer of them. And so women do more of the work. And women appear to respond to this partly by increasing their schooling and labor supply. And that, in fact, that's one of the dynamics that's going on here, right? As men become less marriageable, women naturally respond by investing more in education and labor market activities because they're going to be the sole provider in many circles. Okay, this is the same x-axis of changes in male earnings among workers. This y-axis is the change in the fraction currently married among women ages 25 to 39 of the same education and race groups. So what you can see is women are not getting married. So if so, I'm assuming an assumption here is that there's a good degree of homophily. So I've introduced for the sociologists in the room. Thank you. women of the same, I'm assuming that women of the same education and race are likely to marry men of that education and race, so disproportionately, not one for one, of course. And women are not tending to marry these males that have falling earnings. Now, interestingly, and this is, you know, this is really meant to be descriptive. This is not a causal statement. But if you were to, for example, regress the change in female marriage rates as a fraction married, this is not ever married or will marry, but currently married among 25 to 39, on both the change, it, first regress it on the change in male earnings, that's this, right? Regress on the change in female earnings, you would also find a negative relationship. If you regress it on both, you would find that the male variable is significant, statistically significant and positive, i.e. higher male earnings, higher marriage rates, falling male earnings, falling marriage rates. And the female, the own earnings variable is not significantly predictive. In fact, I think it's positive, weakly positive. Now, that's hardly a definitive test, but it suggests quite plausibly that women are, choosing rationally, I would say, not to marry these males. There may be other explanations. Some would say, oh, these males are choosing not to marry women. But my reading of the literature is the overarching phenomenon is women are concluding the men are not marriageable. They're sort of another mouth to feed. Here's another way of seeing this. This shows you the fraction currently married by race and gender. And a couple of interesting things sort of stand out here. One is if you go back to the 70s, the marriage rates were much higher, and they were also didn't really differ by education level. And then if you roll the tape forward, for example, if you look at Black men, right, the fraction currently married among people with more than high school education is maybe 45 percentage points, and among high school or less than high school is 20 percentage points, right? You see a similar fanning out for white men. No similar phenomenon for Hispanics, by the way. Marriage rates have fallen, but they've fallen much more for low education males and females, which is consistent with the chart I showed you a moment ago. But what hasn't changed? Oh, sorry. And sorry. Here are those two figures just alongside one another. Okay. But what hasn't changed that much is fertility. So it's fallen somewhat, but so here, this is actually the best way to start at the bottom here. This is the fraction of males and females ages 25 to 39 reporting at least one child in the home. So if we look at women by education, right, we can see it's gone down, maybe 10 percentage points, but not a huge amount, and it hasn't. It's somewhat lower for more educated women, right? Not surprisingly, but it hasn't changed very much. Now, if we look at men, right, we can see, like, for example, among white men, this has fallen on the order of 25 percentage points. Among black men, it's fallen on the order of 35 percentage points, right? And among Hispanic men, it's also fallen on the order of about 25 percentage points, okay? Now, remember that these are the dads of those kids, right? So, in other words, presumably these guys in the upper panel were involved in what was going on in the lower panel. And so what this says is there's a lot of childbearing going on, but the change is that men are not living in households with children. And this is with any children, by the way, be even less lower if we were talking about their own children. So as of 2009, 40% of U.S. births were to unmarried women. So that's rising among every group, right? So here's Caucasians, blacks, Hispanics. Our data don't allow us to distinguish Asians. And you can see it's actually the rate of growth is higher among Hispanics and whites. And by the way, there's no Hispanics identified in the 1980 census than it is among blacks, although the levels are much, much higher. So among, over 70% of all births to African Americans in the U.S. are out of wedlock. And I want to say that this is not just a question of they didn't happen to get married before the baby was born. I'm sure there's some of that, but really you should think of that as a marker of the likely household structure that those kids will experience. Kids that are born into non-married households are much more likely to be in non-married households, and those households are likely to be more unstable. Let's see. So this is a fraction of children younger than 18 living with mother only by mom's race and education. And what you can see, for example, is, again, this is, except among Hispanics, right, it's more concentrated among less educated moms, right? So among blacks, for example, 80% of kids of high school dropout moms are living with the mom only. Right? Among whites, it's around 50%. And again, these differentials are sort of masked by the figure, but this, among people with more than high school education, this is under 20%, and this is about 35%. So I'm gonna speed up just because I want to get to the sort of new stuff. But let me just say, okay, so I mentioned, by the way, if you look at family poverty rates by household type, right, here are female householders, no husband present. Here are male householders, no wife present, right? So there's an enormous gulf between those. So in general, single mom-headed households are relatively poor. Most single households are mom-headed. Okay, there's also important disparities in how those households function. So this is a paper from work by Meredith Phillips that just looks at disparities in weekly time spent. Now here, I'm being a little fast and loose. I'm sort of conflating income with household structure, right? Because that's the way those data are available. Now, these obviously are going to be closely related. As we move into lower quintiles, we're moving into more single parent households, but I'm not able to isolate those effects here. Anyway, this is just time spent in literacy activities by age and household income quintile relative to the fifth quintile. So what you can see, for example, this differential of 1.5 hours a week, right? One and a half hours per week, right? Amounts to a couple thousand hours, right? Between ages 0 and 8 or so, right? It's actually not at all a small difference in what's going on, and it's perfectly natural to think, of course, some of this comes from education, some of this comes from income, but some of it obviously comes directly from time availability. Right? Second piece of evidence just relating these things is this is from the Duncan and Murnane volume, the Wither Opportunity volume. It just shows you per capita enrichment expenditures on children at the top versus bottom quartile of households between 1973 and 2005-2006, and this is just remarkable. Right. If you look at this, how much more high education or high income households are spending on their kids, and there's not been a fourfold increase actually in income differentials between the top quintile and the bottom quintile. Right. This is a deliberate change of how people want to invest resources. This shows you. I'm going to stop with the sort of descriptive part of the talk. This is the gap in years of completed schooling in top versus bottom quintiles for cohorts born 1968 to 1996. I believe this is from the PSID. And you can sort of see, right, this kind of pulling apart, which is surprising, I think, or maybe not surprising. Related to that, and this is also from the same book, this is the paper by Bailey and Donarski, you see this differential this steepening of the slope of the relationship between household income and college going, and similarly college completion. And you might have thought in a time when college going rates were rising that you could have seen that slope flatten, right? That basically, as access becomes more equitable and more people are going, in the limit if everyone was going, there would be no household income differential. We've not seen that. In fact, so you can see the graduation rate rises from 5% to 9%, right? So you could say, well, that's an 80% increase, but it's from epsilon to epsilon among the lowest quartile to 36% to 54% among the highest quartile. This is not as evident in other countries, right? The U.S. unique system of higher education finance probably contributes a good deal to this. Okay. Oh, last point on this, and then I'm going to move on to facts. Okay. So this just shows you, this is from the paper by Chetty, Hendren, Klein, and Hendren, Where is the Land of Opportunity? And I found this a really striking figure, this is the data, I made the figure. This shows you the intergenerational income correlation between parents and kids. Okay, so the higher that correlation, the lower is mobility.
So
right?
The y-axis or the x-axis? Good.
That's the y-axis. On the x-axis is the share of families in the commuting zone who are with a single mom, right? In other words, so this is looking across commuting zones, clusters of counties. Counties in which more kids are growing up in single-headed households have lower intergenerational mobility, right? The gap between what the parents have achieved and what the kids achieve is substantially smaller, right? And so that's a striking descriptive fact. So if you look in that paper, there's a zillion correlations between the variable to explain is always this intergenerational correlation, right? The lower that is, the less kids' outcomes are predicted by their parents' incomes. And of all the variables they look at, they talk about sprawl, they talk about inequality. This actually turns out to be the most predictive, in fact, is the fraction of single-headed households. All right, good. So now I'm going to try to actually present some novel evidence on this set of questions. So the hypothesis that we were particularly focused on was really specifically about not the effect of single-headedness and so on, but the differential effect. The reason for that is it's actually hard. It's hard to identify the direct effect of single-headedness. There's so many things that go into that. On the other hand, the gender gap is much more manageable, and I'll show you what I mean by that. So I'll just say that there is evidence out there that's suggestive of this gender gap relationship. So, for example, this is a paper, again, from the same... this is not from St. Bond, but this is a paper by Jacob and Wilder, and they look at the fraction of 12th graders expecting to obtain a BA by sex and parents' education. And an interesting fact that comes out here is that it's sort of rising for everybody, but there's a much greater gap among kids of gender gap among kids of low education versus high education parents, right? And that's the kind of phenomenon we're zeroing in here is looking at household disadvantage or household differentials, that they seem to be not just differing in levels, but also differing in the way they boys and girls are potentially responding to them. I realize that's indirect. Okay, so I'll say that there's a bunch of papers on this. I mentioned the evidence by Phillips. I mentioned the article by Bailey and Donarski. I mentioned Jacob and Wilder. There's also a paper by Jessica Pan and Marianne Bertrand and the AEJ recently that looks at, it's called The Trouble with Boys, and it looks at gender differences in disruptive behavior and relates them to household structure. So that's actually what we're closely related to. I mentioned all these things. So now let me tell you what we're going to do. Okay, so we're gonna do two things. So this is drawing on the work with David Figlio, Chris Carbonic, and Melanie Wasserman. So the first thing we're going to do is a very simple cross-state analysis, just to look at changes in household structure and how they relate to outcomes of kids, in particular by cohort, in terms of test scores. Then the next thing we're going to do is we're actually going to look at a very detailed data set linking birth records to school records from the state of Florida. This is what we call the Figlio file. And that will be more powerful. So let me just describe, this is just by way of motivation. So what this is the outcome that will either be test scores or educational attainment of kids born in state J in cohort C by race. And then the explanatory variable here will be the fraction of moms who were married in that birth by state by race cohort, right? Calculated from the vital statistics data. So the likelihood that you were born into a married household, right? And then we have a main effect for to allow for gender differential, and then an interaction between gender and marital status. Okay. So very simple cross-state regression, and not very powerful. Here is, so this just shows you, so this is the NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress, fourth grade reading scores, right? These are standardized. So this says, on average, males are about 0.2 standard deviations below females in the fourth grade, and that in a state with a 10 percentage increase in the marriage rate in a state is predictive of a 6 percentage point, 6 tenths of a standard deviation gain in the, no, sorry, 6 one-hundredths standard deviation gain of the of this test score. Okay. In the next column, we put in an interaction between male and mother married. And this says, basically, the male main effect is actually, it's now substantially larger. It's 0.3, so that says that's the effect for unmarried, for males from unmarried households, and then for married households, that closes the gap about halfway. Descriptively, I want to be clear, we're not linking males to the household structure, right? This is just a state aggregate. In the third column, we put in the state fixed sex and race by state effects, sex and race by time trend, and it doesn't survive it. I mean, it's descriptively still there, but it's not robust. Then we do it separately for whites and blacks. You find something similar for blacks. We continue to find this effect. Okay, we do the same thing for math scores. Math scores are we find something roughly similar. This survives in this column. But doesn't survive when you disaggregate by race. I could show you the same thing by education, but let me not. So here's what we want to do. So imagine the following. Imagine we could estimate the gender gap within moms by marital status. Okay. So here's a unmarried household, person I, a child I, born to mom J, and mom J is unmarried, and so we have a mom fixed effect. And then we have a coefficient for males, right? So we can have, so if you could imagine, for example, you couldn't estimate that if you only had one kid, right? So you have to need two kids. In fact, to identify this, one of them has to be a boy and one has to be a girl, right? So you could do the same thing for the married household, right? And you could estimate this beta, right? So this is the unmarried beta. And our hypothesis is that this, if this outcome is something positive, like education, right, that this effect will be, that in general the male effect will be negative in both households, males will do worse, but the effect will be smaller in the married household than the unmarried household. So the gender gap differential would then just be beta married minus beta unmarried. You can do that as a pooled regression, right, and you put in an exhaustive set of mom-fixed effects, and you're just contrasting within siblings, right, in terms of these outcomes, and asking, you have a mom-fixed effect, a male effect, and then a male times married effect. And identification could come from comes from within and across family contrasts. You can look within family over time. There's no random assignment of kids to families, right? So the only thing we're thinking of here is that sex is randomly assigned within a household. So the data source is the Figlio file. So this is all Florida birth records between 1992 and 2002. And they contain race, marital status, mom's education, neonatal health measures. They're matched school records if the kid remains in Florida and attends a public school. And this includes test scores, absences, disciplinary incidents, and suspensions. And so to implement the thing I just described, we can use multiple sources of variation. One thing we can look at is gender discordant twins, right? Brothers and sisters who were born at the same time to the same mom. That's an oddball sample, right? Their twins are different in a variety of ways, but we can do that. We can also look at gender discordant sequential births with concordant marital status, i.e. moms who are married or unmarried at the time of both births. Same mom, right? Same marital status, different gender of the kid. Or we can also use moms who change marital status over time, right, between kids. So those are the ways we can get at this. So again, let me be clear. We're not attempting to identify the direct effect of mom's structure on kid outcome. We're trying to ask the differential effect by gender, right? Because we don't think of household structures being randomly assigned, we think of gender as being randomly assigned, and so we can identify the interaction between gender and household structure. So 2 million births, the match rate is about 80%. Almost all the attrition is due to out-of-state moves and non-public school attendees. Okay, And there, some of this is documented in Figlio, Gurian, Carbonic, Roth, AR 45. Okay. So just to give you a sense of these data, really amazing resource, and David deserves tremendous credit for having spent years developing these data. So just to give you a sense of, for example, the full population of Florida births are 22% black, 23% Hispanic. If you look at the matched ones, they're 26% black and 18% Hispanic. What's going on? Well, blacks in general are less mobile, and Hispanics are more mobile out of the state of Florida. If you look at education, high school dropouts, that was twins, I apologize. So if you look at high school dropouts, as you restrict the sample, their fraction grows, right, because they're less mobile. College graduates, their fraction shrinks. If you look at people who are married at the time of birth, right, their fraction also shrinks as we restrict the sample. Why? Well, one, they are more likely to send their kids to private school, and two, they're more educated and therefore likely to be more mobile. Okay. All right. Good. So now, just to show you, I think this is very striking to me. I should say, I'm looking at these results for the second time, and you're looking at them for the first time, so we may all be surprised. So this just shows you the transition matrix of marital status of mothers at first and second birth. These are the two oldest kids in our sample. Okay, so first the marginals. This is all births. This is birth length to test scores. These panels are almost the same, so you can just focus on one. So 15% are born with dad absent, 23% unmarried dad present, 60% married. So this basically says 40% of births in Florida are to unmarried households. Now, if you look at dad absent on the first kid, there's a 60% chance that dad will be absent on the second kid too, right? In probably a large number of cases, that's a different dad. For unmarried dad present, again, a 61% that there'll be unmarried dad present on the second birth, right? And then for married, 85% probability they'll be married on the next round as well. So I guess the point that I want to make here is that marital status really does convey, this doesn't prove instability. I mean, it could be the same dad who's absent, the same dad, but I suggest that these states are not, people aren't moving between these states at very high frequency. All right, so now I'm going to first just show you some contrast in mom-kid demographics at birth. This is really just to show you how different these different populations are. This is not the inferential part of the talk. I just want to show you that if you stratify kids by household structure, you see that there's an enormous amount of covariates that move along with it, which is why it's so hard to learn anything about household structure. Okay, then I'll get to the inferential part, which is the sibling contrast and outcomes. Okay, so so here we go. So for example, if we look at these are siblings, gender discordant siblings, these are twins. Okay, so among those who are married, 11% are black. 41% of black among dad present but not married, 64% black among dad absent. Okay, if we look at mom's education below 12, 50% of those with dad absent, 7% of those who are married have less than a high school degree. If we look at age below 22, 70% of those with dad absent, 58% dad present, 12% married. Right, something similar with twins as well. Although interestingly, twins are much less likely to be born to young moms. Does anyone know why? Fertility, exactly. Fertility, IVF, right? So, okay. So twins are born to higher educated households, right, by and large. So anyway, as you move these things, this variable, dad absent, dad present, not married, it's really telling you a lot about all the other things that go along with that, right? So it's a very powerful predictor. That doesn't mean but you should be very leery of drawing any causal inference from that because the demographic groups are so different. Okay, this is also interesting. So if you look at the fraction, there's actually some slight gender differences. Those are actually significant in a sample of these size between these household structures. If you look at birth weight, right, strongly declining in marital status, right, or, married parents have heavier kids. If you look at the Apgar score, which is a measure of the health, right, so the one-minute Apgar score is lowest among dad absent. Same here. Okay, so clearly lots and lots and lots of differences between these households. Okay. This is just five academic outcomes I'm going to focus on. Kindergarten readiness, that's just an indicator variable. Pooled test scores, actually I'm going to have reading and math separate. Those are the combined test scores in 3rd through 10th grade of these kids. Number of disciplinary incidents, number of days suspended and rate of absences is just a fraction of days that they miss. So, for example, kindergarten readiness strongly declining as we move rightward. Number of incidents, 0.52 on average among kids born to non-dad absent households, so half an incident. Number of days suspended, 1.2. And then even these rates of absence, I should add another digit here, 6% versus 4%. That's actually quite a big difference. So in many, many ways, you can say this is very predictive of, you know, lots and lots of other things that are going to happen. Okay, so now we're going to look at sibling outcomes contrast. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to contrast neonatal outcomes, right, and ask whether household structure is predictive of boy-girl differences in neonatal, you know, at differences at birth. So here we go. So let me just explain what these are. So this is infant birth weight. Okay, males weigh more than females. Something you learned today, you can take that home. Okay. Kids born to married weigh another 20 grams. And then there's no contrast here, so there's no differential between males and married. Okay. If you look at the twins column, there's a slight differential. It's very, very small. If we look at other things, gestation weeks, that obviously is constant within twins, birth complications, congenital disorders, 1 minute Apgar, 5 minute Apgar. So what this says is we don't see, if we look at sibling differences, right, we don't see that mom's marriage status predicts sibling differences at birth. It's not that married moms have better boys, right, relative to the girls that they have, as we can measure by health at birth, okay? This is important. I'm focusing on this because it's pretty critical to what we're doing, right? If we failed this, then we would be dead in the water. Yeah?
That's a question on the battle to the concern I was raising earlier.
Oh, okay. I mean, okay. But I think your point does definitely go through about these interactions. Okay, so now I'm going to look at academic and disciplinary outcomes. Okay, so I'm going to do this for three types of families. All siblings, okay, regardless, and here the marital status can change over time. This is siblings born to the same marital status, right? So either the mom was married both occasions or not married. And here I'm going to look at twins. And, of course, for twins, there's no married main effect, right? Because either they're married or unmarried, right? So it's absorbed by the household fixed effect. Okay, so we look at kindergarten readiness. There's some evidence. So first, again, males are less ready for kindergarten, right? All of you have boys, right? No surprise. But parents are more ready to send them to kindergarten. and then there's a positive male-married interaction. In other words, about a third of that differential seems to close for boys relative to their sisters in married households. Okay, if we look at the pooled math scores, this is significantly positive. Same with reading. It's not true in the twins. So, you know, there are multiple ways to interpret that. One is that the twins are better control, right? So we should take that one more seriously. Another is that they're somehow a more exotic sample. If we look now, here's where the really big differences start to show up, and this is consistent with the work by Bertrand and Pan, is in disciplinary outcomes, right? So if we look at number of incidents, right, boys have about 0.4 more incidents through the 10th grade, 15% lower among married households, and then this is enough to close the gap. So male to female, there's essentially no additional differential, right? So this says boys in married households have no more disciplinary incidents than their sisters, right? If we look at days suspended, something very similar. Huge difference, right? Smaller married households, much smaller among the boys of those households. Or pool rate of absences. Higher absence rate, lower for married, lower again for the boys in those households. So here we go. So I'm going to do this separately for blacks and whites. Okay, and here we start to lose some power. So no difference on, no effect on kindergarten readiness, no effect on these test scores. However, on incidents, right, again we see this. So this is black males, much higher rate of incidents than whites. So this is sort of maybe perhaps goes to the point you were making about blacks versus whites being treated differently. And then, but the married effect is negative, and then the married times male effect is also quite negative, right? So proportionally, it's about the same for whites and blacks, but it's twice as large for blacks as it is for whites. Same thing if we look at days suspended. Same thing if we look at absences, right? So again, we see in all these cases, On these sort of disciplinary indicators, kids in black households do have more disciplinary incidents than kids in white households. Males have more relative to their sisters, and then, but if the household is married, that differential is closed on the order of about 50%, as far as we can measure it. If we look at twins, something similar. This, now the samples get really small, but actually it's surprisingly consistent. Let me do one more breakdown. And break it down by mom's education. Okay, so this is education at the child's birth. So we have less than 12, 12 to 15, and above 15. So again, on kindergarten readiness, nothing. On test scores, nothing. But then on disciplinary incidents, and this is, again, suggestive of the pattern I showed for white and black, right? The differences are lower for males. The gaps are lower for males in higher educated households, right? The contrast between boys and girls in married households is about half the underlying difference, the boy-girl difference in unmarried households of the same education. So again, I'm contrasting brothers and sisters within a household, right? And I'm saying that the contrast is greater, so the boys are doing worse, but then in married households, the differential is not so much. So I think that's a valid contrast. However, it doesn't tell you per se that it's marriage, like it's not the direct effect of blah, you're married, you know, and that's good for the kids. It could work through a variety of channels, right? So one channel could be, you know, the one you most concretely imagine. There's the dad saying, "Don't act out in school," you know, or "I will discipline you." Another possibility is it's the neighborhoods and schools that they live in, right? So even holding mom's education constant, married moms are going to live in better neighborhoods, and that could differentially affect boys and girls, right? Boys, you know, when moms, single moms, worry about neighborhood effects, they worry a lot about boys, right? They worry about boys getting into trouble, boys getting involved in, you know, violence or dangerous activities. So those channels, something we can explore and are exploring in our data, right? So we can put in zip code effects and interact them with gender, right? We can put in some other. Zip code is the best one we have. We have some information about school systems. So we can ask whether, you know, is, so at least to me, and maybe it's because I'm not, haven't thought about this long or hard enough, this seems very compelling that there is, that these differences in gender, these gender differences in outcomes are real. They're not an artifact of who's in what household. That the household structure is strongly predictive, but we don't know through what channels.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.